From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal, and Bor Den, correspondent for the Times of London. And our moderator is Paul Brandis, White House correspondent for USA Today and West Wing Reports.
Hello, thank you for joining us, and here are the issues. U.S. President Donald Trump has fired another national security advisor, John Bolton. America marks the anniversary of the 2001 terror attacks on New York and Washington. The president also says peace talks with the Taliban are dead, this after the death of an American soldier in Afghanistan. The fight for the Democratic Party nomination heats up with a debate among the 10 leading candidates and Britain's Brexit battle, multiple setbacks for new Prime Minister Boris Johnson. What happens now? Well, let's start with the firing of John Bolton. He, of course, was President Trump's national security advisor. There have now been five in less than 3 years, if you count one man who served for about a week, I think. Trump says that he and Bolton did not agree on the overall direction of foreign policy. Tom, what happened?
Well, I think it's a yet another reminder, Paul, that President Trump is running his own foreign policy. He has very strong views, and he does not listen, or he's not prone to listen much to his political and especially his geopolitical advisors. It's interesting to me that when the Trump administration was trying to put together a government during the transition of 2016 and 2017, his foreign policy team was told by some of the most senior foreign policy leaders in the Republican establishment, whoever you pick, whatever you do, don't give John Bolton anything. He's a loose cannon. He's not a team player. He requires frequent adult supervision. But then the word is that several months ago or a year or so ago, Trump became enamored of Bolton because he liked his tough guy talk on Fox News. And Trump fancies himself as the ultimate tough guy. And he really didn't, as far as can be told. And he didn't do any consulting with people who would have said to him, Mr. President, be careful on this. The irony is, of course, that some around Mr. Trump, President Trump, think that Bolton was not wrong to disagree with the president on Iran, to disagree with the president on policies towards North Korea, and several other things. The president later said it was because he basically didn't work and play well with others. He said, Bolton and I get along, but that's no evidence that that's the case.
Now, Boris Bolton had, as Tom said, this reputation as a hardliner. He spent basically his entire career, frankly, advocating, for example, for attacking Iran and things like that. Does his ouster suggest perhaps a more conciliatory tone from the president towards, say, Iran and other trouble spots?
I think that's the thing that people are certainly watching very closely ahead of the UN meeting that's coming up later this month. Since Bolton's ouster, we've had some clues that there might perhaps be an opening to speak to the Iranians, with Pompeo saying, well, maybe there can be a meeting, the Iranians saying, sort of viewing Bolton's ouster very favorably, saying, you know, Americans getting rid of the warmongers is certainly a good sign. It's been privately reported that John Bolton thought that meeting with the Iranians would be a bad idea for Trump because he wasn't tough enough, that he gives away too much in negotiations, which, of course, Trump has denied. But at the same time, I do think that is the open question, whether or not Trump will meet the foreign minister later this month. The signs for an opening seem to be there. However, the calculation for Trump would certainly be a dangerous one.
Well, a couple of years ago, it would seem unthinkable that he would meet with the Iranians, but then it also seemed unthinkable that he would set foot in North Korea, and he did that. So perhaps talking with the Iranians now doesn't seem that far-fetched. In fact, I think he has said, Tom, that he'd be willing to do that without any preconditions, but the Iranians say, look, you still got to ease these sanctions.
It's also apparent that he was willing, as we know now, he was willing, President Trump was willing to host Taliban leaders at Camp David, what John Bolton and many of his other senior advisors thought was a particularly ill-advised idea. And he said, that's dead, at least it's dead for now. I think what this is showing us is, if we didn't have plenty of evidence already, is President Trump loves the show, the spectacle. He's always looking to make a splash, stepping across the line of the demilitarized zone to meet Kim Jong-un. He's a showman.
The television moment.
Exactly right. And Trump, more than any other president of the 10 I've covered, savors the presidential moment. He craves it more than any of the others.
Of course, the question is whether these television moments actually, you know, lead to anything substantive. And in North Korea, I think it's reasonable to say so far, in fact, that it has not. And I'm glad you brought up the Camp David proposed meeting, Tom, because that is sort of the next thing that I wanted to talk about here. Of course, here in the United States, we just marked the 18th anniversary, hard to believe, 18 years, mm-hmm. of these terror attacks on New York and Washington. These Islamic terrorists, Al-Qaeda, of course, hijacked these four airplanes, attacked New York and Washington. And ever since then, we've been at war in Afghanistan. And that includes against the Taliban, which is still there. So 18 years later, we're still fighting them. And then all of a sudden, President Trump, looking perhaps to wind down this war, perhaps to get out, came up with the idea, as you said, of inviting the Taliban to Camp David. The meeting was called off, as you say, but the point was he actually thought about inviting this terrorist group to Camp David?
Well, he didn't just think about it doing it. It was in the works. It was going to happen. It got called off at the last minute because of this terror attack in Afghanistan. I should add as a footnote, Paul, that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who is intensely ambitious, and I will predict a year from now he'll be running for the U.S. Senate from his home state of Kansas. But Pompeo was all for the meeting at Camp David. Bolton was unalterably opposed, and this is one of many instances where Pompeo is playing to the president what the president wants to do, and Bolton thought it was a bad idea.
I think, to add to Tom's point earlier, too, it shows the extraordinary risks that Trump is willing to take in order to create these sort of moments where he sort of fancies himself as this great deal maker. And sort of not surprisingly, it received a lot of backlash even from his own party here in the U.S. with Liz Cheney saying, you know, the Taliban should never set foot in Camp David. You know, how could this be? And, you know, Republicans and Democrats coming together on that. And the extraordinary risk, I think, was really highlighted. We've got some reporting in the Times this week where we spoke to Taliban leaders who said, we fought for 18 years, we're going to keep fighting for 100 years. We declined the invitation to come to Camp David. And the fact that that was disclosed via a tweet just, again, goes back to the sort of extraordinary nature of this this presidency. And I think just one last point, which is that the ousting of Bolton in relation to his opposition to some of these ideas that President Trump has had, Paul, to your point, you know, some of these quote-unquote big negotiations, big moments, haven't really delivered a foreign policy win for Trump. And I think Bolton's ousting comes at a time when Trump is really looking for one as we get closer to next year.
Now, beyond the sort of the theatrics of all of this, he likes the big television spectacle. But the underlying question, of course, is the issue itself. 18 years of war in Afghanistan, seemingly no way out. And Trump, you know, he still wants to keep several thousand troops, 8,000 or 9,000 troops there, I believe. What happens to our presence in Afghanistan? It seems endless.
I think it is endless given the geopolitical realities of the day, including the ongoing global terrorism threat. But candidate Trump campaigned on getting out of Afghanistan. It's very important to him. And he's at this part of his reelection cycle where he's decided, understandably so, that it is very critical for him to be able to show not only that he's won some victories, but that he's made good on some of his campaign pledges in Afghanistan. A withdrawal from Afghanistan is at the top of his list.
Yeah. But Paul, I think you're right that, you know, even the deal that was on the table kept 5,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan, would have left something like 9,000 still there. And the tragedy that sort of Trump pointed to predicate the withdrawal was the 16th death of an American soldier in Afghanistan this year. So even that sort of under those limited conditions, I think Tom is right. The withdrawal is still not a full withdrawal. It's still a quagmire after.
Well, that's
all
the other
years.
Thing, by the way. It took the death of, as you say, the 16th American there this year to be killed, and that was enough for him to call off these talks. But apparently, the deaths of number 1 through 15, he was still planning to have the talks. So I'm a little confused by the inconsistency of that.
Well, it's hard to be able to follow the president. One day he'll say he's going to do this, and the next day he'll change his mind, and then his aides will say he never said that or whatever. He is flexible, let's put it that way. And I know we have to move to another topic, but I want to add something very quickly about Bolton and Trump that we haven't spoken about. Deep differences in Russia. Bolton is very suspicious of the Russians. He thinks they're bad guys. He thinks that they pull the wool over the president's eyes. And the president, as he's made very clear, he wants to have a better relationship with the Russians and Vladimir Putin. This was might have been the first sticking point between President Trump and Ambassador Bolton, from which all these other problems have flowed. So Bolton was really up against it from the start.
Yeah, it makes you wonder, to something you said earlier, why he even hired him in the first place, just because he saw him on television. He looked good, but Bolton has been talking about Russia for years, and it seems like the president didn't seem to take notice of that.
I don't think he did. I think he was just looking at, I want somebody who's tough. Toughness and strength is very important, or the perception of toughness and strength is very important to President Trump.
All right. Perception and reality are sometimes quite different things. Let's pause for a short break. More Issues in the News in just a moment.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to National Journal, and Bo Dien, correspondent for the Times of London. Our moderator is Paul Brandis, White House correspondent for USA Today and West Wing Reports.
Welcome back. The top 10 candidates for the Democratic Party's nomination met for a debate in Houston, Texas, the biggest city in that very important state. And the top three candidates continue to be, and it's been this way for a while now, Vice President Joe Biden and two incumbent senators, Elizabeth Warren, she's from the state of Massachusetts, and Bernie Sanders, he is from Vermont, two states in the northeastern part of the U.S. So 10 candidates, Tom. What stuck out for you?
What stuck out for me, Paul, was a sense that Vice President, former Vice President Joe Biden, steadied himself. He came out of the gate fired up, ready to go, showing a lot of energy. There have been criticisms that he's too old, maybe he's lost it, and is weak, is getting weak, and he took too many punches in the first two debates, but he was showing a lot of vigor, and he was on the offensive, aggressive, and I think it helped him, and I think it helped, who knows what's going to happen in the next 14 months, but it steadied his front-running lead at the moment. All the Democratic polls show that he is still the preferred candidate within the Democratic Party. Senator Sanders has made up some ground. Senator Warren is beginning to surge. But Biden is still at the top of the pile, and he helped himself a lot in this debate.
And what about you, Boer? What stuck out for you?
Yeah, I definitely agree with Tom. I think it was the former vice president's best performance of the three that have so far taken place, because he sort of gave quite a solid performance. He cements his place as a front runner. I thought that Senator Warren, who's been making a lot of grounds in the past few weeks with her campaigning, she's sort of had this great ability to marry her very her left-wing policies with these very personable stories, performed well. She's got a plan for everything. People like that about her. And it was a substantive debate in terms of the discussions on healthcare, especially, which is a top issue for voters, on immigration, on trade. And I think the tenor of the debates has risen since the first few.
It was also notable that, as Bohr says, that health care was the dominant issue, and that this was an instance where Biden was much tougher on the others on this, saying basically Senator Warren's plan and Senator Sanders' plan can't be paid for. It's not workable. The whole notion of making Medicare, the senior citizens, government-funded health program available for everybody, Biden just says, we don't have the money to pay for that. But what it told you is health care is very much on the minds of Democratic voters. And Senator Warren in particular thinks that this is an issue that will cause her to break through.
As all of these 10 candidates kind of, you know, get into the weeds of important issues like that, they agree on sort of the big picture here, more health care for everybody and try and make it affordable and everything. But the one thing they all agree on is that none of this can happen, of course, if President Trump gets reelected. That's their overriding goal, is to get President Trump out of office. And Tom, you said one thing earlier that I wanted to come back to, that Biden is the preferred candidate, preferred in terms of electability, you mean, and beating President Trump?
Right. The one that I think what fuels his front runner status is the belief that he is the likeliest Democratic candidate to beat President Trump. And they all know, as you said, all the things that Democrats stand for and want to see happen in this country will not happen with another 4 years of President Trump. And so I think the electability argument plays into Biden's favor in the fact that he didn't stumble and fumble and bumble and look tired or weak or confused last night, with small exceptions. Everybody makes mistakes. But that was a real positive for Biden.
Is it your sense, Bohr, that he's the most electable person?
So I think two points that Tom bring up are quite interesting. One, it was definitely quite clear on the stage that there were two strategies going on. One set of candidates who were sort of very much pitching to a Democratic primary voters, talking about the need for sort of big, bold ideas, and candidates who were addressing more directly or indirectly the need to take on President Trump. Besides Biden sort of talking about what getting back to American values and what's feasible and what is appealing to ordinary voters, you know, you've got other centrist candidates, people like Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg and Kamala Harris having a moment saying, either directly addressing Trump or saying, look, we've only got one chance to make him a one-term president. The struggle, I think, that was highlighted for Biden is that, which was quite clear in the debate last night, is that he's in this position where he has to not only lay out his vision for 2020, but he's being forced to defend his very long record. And that was quite apparent in the Obamacare or Affordable Health Care Act debate last night, where he's saying, look, I'm building upon the legacy of Barack Obama, but also I'm expanding upon that. So I think that's the question for voters next time, right, is like, well, is the continuation of the Obama 2.0 under Biden the most electable brand that we have?
That's a really good point. And, you know, Tom, it's important to remember that Barack Obama is the first Democratic president to win back-to-back terms with a majority of the vote since Franklin D. Roosevelt, who was president in the 30s and 40s. And yet there are a lot of Democrats now who are saying, well, we have to move beyond that. Very popular a figure, and yet Biden is obviously, as Bohr said, he's tying himself to the Obama legacy, this very popular man. But other Democrats are saying, well, we have to move beyond that, move beyond an extremely popular man like that? Is that a risky strategy?
It is tricky, because you do not want to alienate African-American voters, especially since they, by and large, African-American voters have no use for President Trump. That voting block is robust and will be robust in 2020, so you don't want to put that at risk. I mean, the overarching challenge for Democrats, I would say, is they've got to figure out a way to have some energy to talk about the future, not about the past, but to not go too far to the left so that it feeds right into the emerging Trump strategy. I mean, you see President Trump's campaign manager, everybody else, they keep referring to the Democrats as socialists, and Trump talking about socialism, and they are hoping people will decide, enough voters will decide, that the Democrats are just too far left. In fact, they're socialists, and in fact, Bernie Sanders refers to himself as a is a socialist, that they're hoping that that will be enough to scare off some traditional Democrats and either keep them at not voting or voting for Trump. So the Democrats have this dilemma. They have to harness the energy of younger Democratic voters and voters to the left of the mainstream in the party without alienating the electorate. I mean, it's usually when a political party goes too far to one extreme, it's trouble. In 1964, the Republicans nominated Barry Goldwater far to the right, and he was destroyed by Lyndon Johnson. In 1972, the Democrats named George McGovern, and he was too far to the left, and
he got
trounced by Richard Nixon. So the key is to harness the energy and the enthusiasm on the Democratic left without giving Trump too much of a way to say they're all crazy, wacko, elite socialists who will destroy our country.
To square the circle here, that's perhaps where Biden comes back in, because he's trying to position himself as more of a centrist.
I am quite curious. I suspect Tom and Paul, you guys will both have interesting thoughts about this. But I am quite curious about the demographic changes in 2020 and how that will kind of change the conversation. Because as you say, there is this need to harness the energies of voting blocs without alienating others. And I think in 2020, young people will, for the first time, make up a very significant portion of the vote. And it's clear that some of the more left-wing candidates are pitching in that direction. So it'll be interesting to see where those shifts turn out.
Okay, we've got to move on. Just a couple of minutes left. And I did want to talk about one more issue across the pond, as they say in Great Britain, one of the world's great democracies, of course. Prime Minister Boris Johnson's only been on the job for, a couple of weeks, maybe a month or so at most. And his plan to leave the European Union is just a mess. It's frankly hard to follow. A parliament has forbidden him to leave Europe without a deal. It's rebuffed his call for an election before October 31st. There are allegations he lied to Queen Elizabeth. Can you make heads or tails of this? Who wants to take this, Tom?
Well, it's very tricky because the British Parliament is supposedly the mother of all legislative democracies. Calling it a mess is charitable, Paul. I don't know what's going to happen, but I would bet that Johnson will probably set a new record as the shortest serving prime minister in the history of the UK.
I'm going to have to correct
a British correspondent
on that point. We were actually taking bets about this in the office as well. But it seems Johnson may escape by the skin of his teeth, setting that particular record, which I believe is about 111 days, a little over 100 days, 110 days.
That's the shortest?
That's the shortest.
Okay. We're not there yet.
We're not there yet. And, you know, he was very much in danger of that if an election had been called and he had lost it in October, in which case his premiership would have been just short of 90 days. So then he would have set a record. But it seems he's been sort of given a bit of a lifeline in that a big issue that's been sort of clogging up the works in the Brexit deal negotiations, which is the Irish backstop, the idea that there can't be any kind of a full infrastructure border along the North Ireland and Republic of Ireland borders, that the rules about whether or not there are EU laws that will apply to Northern Ireland and not apply to the Republic of Ireland have made a movement forward in that the Unionist Party of Northern Ireland, which was in an alliance with Johnson's predecessor, Theresa May, have sort of agreed to relax a little bit on their demands. And Johnson will be meeting with Juncker, the European Commission president, next week. So we'll see where that goes.
Well, two prime ministers have lost their jobs over this Brexit mess since 2016. Of course, David Cameron, and then, as Boris said, Theresa May. And quickly, what's the betting line in your office on Johnson? 111 or 111 days?
I'd best not say, because I would jinx it. But, you know, as you mentioned earlier, the tricky domestic question now is this constitutional crisis that's going on.
Okay, anyway, we'll have to end it right there. I'm sure we're going to be talking about this much more often in the future. Our thanks, meantime, to two of Washington's most prominent journalists, Bor Deng, she's the Washington correspondent for The Times of London, and Tom DeFrank, he's contributing editor to National Journal. This program was produced by Kim Lewis, our engineer Justin Thwaites, and I'm Paul Brandis of West Wing Reports in USA Today. Thank you very much for joining us. From VOA, the Science Edition.